Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with your host, executive editor of Newsbusters, Tim Graham.
Welcome, welcome, Newsbusters listeners, to the first Newsbusters podcast of 2022. Your host, Tim Graham, is still away, though he's still cranking out new pieces for us on the website. You can go check it out. His latest column is up on the media's obsession with January 6th. The anniversary is coming up this week. I'm your fill-in host, Nick Night Train Fondacaro, but I am without my right-hand man today, Curtis Houck. He was supposed to be back in time for today's podcast, but he was kept at bay because of the snow day we had in the D.C. area yesterday and earlier this week. Instead, I'm joined by our research director, Scott Whitlock. Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Always fun to be here.
Speaking of our snow day, you put out a piece yesterday morning about the liberal media or the liberals in general bashing our governor-elect not knowing who's actually the governor of Virginia.
Right. Yeah, it was something that was trending on Twitter, and I kind of clicked on it, baffled at people being unclear who the governor of the state is. But yeah, a lot of liberals were trashing Governor Youngkin, quote unquote, for not handling this disaster that we had on I-95. And if not everyone knows about it, but there was like a 50-mile backup on I-95 when we had this massive snowstorm. People were stuck for like 24 hours. So you had a lot of liberals, some prominent liberals, blaming Governor Youngkin. The only problem here is he's not the governor. That's actually Governor Ralph Northam, who's still the governor for about another 10 days. So I wanted to look into it because it's one thing for liberals on Twitter to be doing this. I wanted to see how the networks were covering it on the morning. And they weren't dumb enough to confuse who the governor is, but they certainly didn't blame Ralph Northam. They didn't give him any grief for this. And I think we all know this is kind of a lower level of what if a Republican governor had done it? What if a Republican president, if Donald Trump had done it? We know that they would totally hold them responsibility, and his name wasn't mentioned.
Just the other year, we had, I believe it was a couple years back, maybe 19, no, I think it was last year, we had in Texas, a similar thing with the snowstorm in Texas, with killing power to a whole bunch of people for a few days, and they made sure to let everybody know that it was the Republican governor who they were saying was sleeping on the job with that one.
Right, absolutely, that's a great point. Look, when they want to nail a Republican governor for failing at something, they do it. And this is kind of like a lower level version of Hurricane Katrina. We all know how they treated George W. Bush when he was president for that. But Ralph Northam's name didn't even come up, despite a myriad of mistakes and missteps that he's made in handling the situation.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of the new year, we had over the weekend Brian Stelter on his quote-unquote reliable sources. He had CNN columnist Nicole Hemmer on, and they wanted to go over some quote-unquote New Year's resolutions for the news media. But they only needed one, even though they said they had multiple. They only needed one, and since it was the midterm election season, it was for the media to work harder at pitching Democrats and claim that literally everything is a threat to democracy. Let's take a listen.
Last but not least this hour, some New Year's resolutions for the news media. Nicole Hemmer is back with me, author of Messengers of the Right. Let's figure out what the press should be doing in the next 12 months. Do you have a resolution for us, Nicole?
I do. The big one is to have a long memory. The destruction of democracy is not a 2020 story. It's not a 2021 story. It's going to be with us into 2022. It's going to be less splashy. It's going to be in state houses and the Supreme Court and in Congress, and it's not going to necessarily come dressed up as an insurrection. So keeping the eye on the story, even when it's not, you know, those gripping images that we've had from the past 2 years.
Right. It's one of these drip, drip, drip events or stories that are hard to cover. But hey, that's an important challenge for the media.
Absolutely.
Right.
Whoa! Did you hear that? Following the legislative process, listening to constituents, and reforming school boards are a threat to democracy. Funny how that works in an election year. And let's look at the docket, since they were talking about the Supreme Court, some of their bigger cases that they're going to be ruling on come this spring. in early summer, protecting the Second Amendment in New York, right to carry outside the home without being New York being a may-issue state, and rather a shall-issue state, protecting the right to life of the unborn with the Mississippi case. That's going to be coming down later this year. And a another case that you may not have heard so much about religious liberty, Carson versus Macon out of Maine, allowing parents to use school programs that give people school choice dollars to go to private schools of their choice. And a mother wanted to send her kids to a religious school, and the program refuses that. All of that is a threat to democracy. So looking at the political leanings of this, clearly the only democracy that they care about is the capital D democracy instead of the lowercase democracy. Then again, we are a constitutional republic and not a true democracy, but I digress. So far, keeping things on Stelter, so far it's been a banger year for Stelter as he's stepped up his unhinged ramblings on the so-called most trusted name in news. On Tuesday, the January 6th committee had released a statement saying that they wanted to speak with Fox News host Sean Hannity about his messages with senior Trump officials and to the president, the former president. And they wanted him to voluntarily come in. It wasn't a formal subpoena. But of course, this gave CNN and Stelter, the anti-Fox News network, because that's pretty much all Stelter really talks about these days is Fox News. Some new ammo and fodder for them to sort of blast at Fox News. Stelter went on to their afternoon programming and accused Hannity of being Trump's quote-unquote shadow chief of staff and being a part of a plot, a secret cabal, to riot at the Capitol. Here's Stelter's ramblings.
Well, I think the big question that a lot of people are going to want to know, including Sean Hannity's viewers, is what is Sean Hannity hiding? What does Hannity know that he's been hiding from his audience? Because he has an audience of millions of people who rely on him, who trust him, who believe him, even though he's given them many reasons to disbelieve. And so what has he been hiding from them for the past year? I think it's very significant this is voluntary. It's not a subpoena. It is not the situation where we're going to be talking about a dramatic First Amendment debate. Certainly, if it did escalate to that point, there would be interesting questions about the role of a media personality who acts as a shadow chief of staff to a former president and what that shadow chief of staff knew in the days leading up to the riot. That's an interesting First Amendment issue at some point, but this is just a voluntary request. And let's also remember that Sean Hannity has repeatedly and loudly for the last 11 or 12 years said that journalism is dead in America. He says journalism is dead, but all of a sudden, as soon as there's a request from a legal committee he doesn't like, he wraps himself in the First Amendment flag and says this would breach the First Amendment. So I think it really comes down to that key question. What's he hiding? What has he known for the past year that he hasn't told his viewers or told the public? Is he in on it in some way? As we know, we're learning about this vast conspiracy. Was he in on it in some fashion? And if not, I'm sure he'll want to share that as well.
Was he in on it? Notice how Stelter speculates about what's actually in the messages. He makes it sound like Hannity was leading that secret cabal of extremists trying to overthrow the government, like as if he was telling they were organizing like which doors to break, which halls to go down. If only we knew what was in those messages. Oh, that's right. We do have the messages. Here's ABC's Chief Washington Correspondent Jonathan Call reading them the very same day.
On December 31st, a week before the insurrection, Hannity seemed to warn Meadows that top lawyers at the White House were on the verge of resigning en masse to protest Trump's plans to overturn the election. He texted, quote, "We can't lose the entire White House counsel's office. I do not see January 6th happening the way he is being told." On January 5th, the day before the insurrection, the committee says Hannity seemed to sound the alarm, texting, "I'm very worried about the next 48 hours. And the next day, those fears were realized. During the riot, Hannity texted Meadows, quote, "Can he make a statement, ask people to leave the Capitol?" That night on Fox News, Hannity condemned the rioters.
"And all of today's perpetrators must be arrested and prosecuted to the full extent of the law."
And days after the riot, Hannity wrote Meadows and Congressman Jim Jordan, describing a difficult conversation he had just had with Trump, writing, quote, "He can't mention the election again, ever. I did not have a good call with him today, and worse, I'm not sure what is left to do or say, and I don't like not knowing if it's truly understood."
That is some good old-fashioned bias by omission from Stelter. Clearly, from some of those messages, Hannity seemed to be a little bit out of the loop, sort of messaging people that he knew, that he knows, that he has relationships with, and not really getting the response that he wanted. It really doesn't sound like somebody being in on it, does it? The messages were out there, but CNN and Stelter didn't want to share them. They would prefer to have the speculation do the talking for them. That way they can have more weight. Later on in the night, they did have them, though, after other news outlets were actually showing them. So, Scott, just to bring you back in here, any sort of reaction to Stelter's little...
That is so bad. That is, you called it bias by omission. It is. It's another way to call it is just absolutely reckless. To just kind of speculate as to what's in these texts when we know what's in the texts. And if you read them, as we just listened to them, Hannity was basically saying, look, you need to do something about this. You need to get these people out of there. You need to get this thing under control.
And even beforehand, he was talking about how afraid of what he's like, you like whoever you're listening to, they're not telling you the right thing. And he's literally says like in the next 48 hours, I'm afraid of what's going to happen. So if he's afraid of what's going to happen, he's not really in on it now, is he?
No. Stelter doing this kind of thing. Look, I've said this before, but listeners should always remember, just in a generic sense, anytime CNN complains about Fox News, you should really just discount it on the same level that if Pizza Hut was complaining about Domino's or Coke was complaining about Pepsi's. They are competitors. Now, one of these two competitors does a lot better than the other one, but they are competitors. So CNN whining about Fox News, you should put a big caveat on that because they are complaining about their competitors who do better than them.
It's also sort of weird that they try to aim at Fox when they probably should be aiming at MSNBC since they sort of have the same market share a little bit in terms of like a more liberal audience. So you would think that they would want to aim for number two, take the number two slot, and then try to go for first instead of just going immediately for first.
Right. It's almost as though MSNBC agrees with them on pretty much everything, so they don't really complain about them. But I just wanted to go back real quick to something else you pointed out on Stelter, which is this whole concept of the making January 6th about everything, making January 6th about the threat to democracy if we don't pass the Democrats' voting rights legislation, or if we don't do this and that, or if Republicans win in 2022. They are really setting this up for everything is January 6th. And if the Democrats don't get what they want, this is a symptom of democracy crumbling. And it's always convenient that when the media does this type of thing in general, it's always to help the Democrats. That's very convenient.
Yeah, like last night on MSNBC Deadline White House, our Kevin Tober wrote last night that Yamiche Alcindor from PBS was doing her commentary on MSNBC, and she claimed that because of the election integrity legislation that's in a lot of states right now, that there is a January 6th every day. There's an insurrection at the Capitol every day.
Right. Yeah. It's absurd. I mean, this is what people have to be prepared about. One of our colleagues, Kyle Drennan, caught CBS essentially saying that, look, hey, if we don't do these things that the Democrats want, if we don't do Build Back Better or the voting rights stuff, then democracy is in peril, just like it was on January 6th. And we were not going to be able to trust the midterm elections in November. Well, now what might happen in the midterm elections in November? Big Republican victory. So there you go. They're already setting it up for you can't trust if Republicans win big, because it's a threat. That's a threat to democracy, too.
last time I checked, at least I've been told, if you question or have concerns about the results of an election, you're threatening democracy and right. you're shaking the foundations.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking of sort of shaking our foundations, we have some freedom of speech and consequences over here on CNN. Also, late in December on the 28th, you had a columnist, and I found this out, and it absolutely disgusted me, Dean Obadiah, who went on this rant in a op-ed that he wrote about the gentleman, the father, who was on the phone with Jared Semek, I believe is how you pronounce his name, the father from Oregon who was on the phone with Joe Biden when he said, let's go Brandon. Aside from Obadiah just being sort of poking fun or complaining about Republicans being the Republicans that use it, he calls them politically correct as opposed to, you know, not being vulgar, overtly vulgar with the true meaning of the phrase, let's go Brandon, even though it has definitely expanded beyond just the right. He like in his piece titled, "You can't troll the president with let's go Brandon and then play the victim," Obadiah actually argues that it's hypocritical of the father to be upset that people are sending him threatening messages. Here's a small excerpt from the piece. Semek complained to the Oregonian that about threatening calls he's received from the live stream saying, "Now I'm being attacked for utilizing my freedom of speech." And what was Obadiah's response? Quote, "Ah, poor victim Semek." He goes on to say, "No one should be able to take it." He says that the father thinks, quote, "No one should be able to take issue with his actions." There's a difference between taking an issue with it and being like, oh, he shouldn't do that, and sending him threatening messages.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, you don't have to be a fan of the phrase, let's go Brandon, to understand that you shouldn't be threatening anyone. And look, we just got done talking about January 6th and threats to democracy and all that. And this just underlines again that, look, liberals, especially liberals in the media, their main concern is not threats to democracy. And in January 6th, their concern is helping the Democrats, or I would say at this point, saving the Democrats from disaster in November. And they really don't care about people like this guy. They don't care if people threatens him. They just want him essentially to be punished. And if he's punished through threats or violence, it sounds like this guy is okay with that.
That this is actually something that I had meant to bring up when we were talking about Stelter earlier, is Stelter has talked on a show about a case where somebody was threatening his family, that they sent him pictures of his parents' place or his in-laws' place, and it went through court, and the guy has been charged and I believe sentenced. The guy was also sending messages to Don Lemon. And it's like, yes, we have this sort of heightened state of agitation in the country over politics, but CNN in particular doesn't seem to think that what they say and the hatred that they stoke against Fox and people on the right can result in the same things that they're being subject to.
Right, right.
And it's sort of...
Look, remember the thing that happened with Tucker Carlson, where the people, when he wasn't home, there were people who were banging on, trying to basically break down the door of his mm-hmm. house. It really shouldn't need to be said to the liberal media or anyone that, look, don't threaten people. And don't encourage violence. And don't just condemn it when it's on one side and celebrate it when it's on another side.
Exactly. And also report it when it's happening to both sides. Because I remember, I actually looked this up recently, and I'll probably tweet it out after we record the podcast here. But I did a report back in the 2018 midterms of this whole rundown list of different attacks on Republican lawmakers running in sort of liberal states where they were attacked. There was one candidate in California who was attacked by, there was at like a state fair or a county fair, and a guy charged him, like tried to come at him with a knife. And then you had different offices like get shot at. One, there was an arson, I think, in South Carolina, I want to say that there were, and even during the 16, there was a firebombing of a Republican office.
Let's not forget Rand Paul.
Oh, exactly. Getting beat up by his neighbor. And then there was at the after the Republican convention at the White House in 2020, there was the mob outside the White House that was pelting Rand Paul or going after Rand Paul and other Republican lawmakers outside the White House as they were leaving the event.
Yeah. I mean, the Rand Paul thing, there were several people in the media, both political media and entertainment media, that basically celebrated the guy that beat him up, his neighbor. It's disgusting.
Yeah. And it's a lot of it does seem to be that they're mostly concerned with their safety as opposed to Republicans. And it's going towards a really bad place. And that's one of the big things that the media, a true resolution, New Year's resolution for the media would be to look in the mirror and sort of tone down the rhetoric that they want stopped.
Right.
So speaking about bettering oneself, we also had last night our Kevin Tober again reported on Stephanie Ruhle, the business correspondent over at NBC. She also hosts a show on MSNBC. Where she was sort of spinning the jobs numbers that came out, that we had 4.5 million workers in America quit their jobs. I know I have some friends on the Republican side who do see some of this as a good thing because they are freelancers, and a lot of those people are going into more freelance positions, but not all of them. A lot of them are quitting for other reasons, but Stephanie Ruhle wanted to say that this is a big boon for the economy. It's a quote, sign of strength.
It's amazing. I mean, it really just shows that, look, they're going to try and spin anything for Biden and the Democrats to try and save them, whether it's this, whether, look, we're just talking about inflation. A lot of their attitude is basically like, oh, grow up, stop complaining about it. And look, you have to be really out of touch to not understand that attitude and pushing that narrative, that's not going to fly, and that's not going to do well for the Democratic Party, but they're sure trying.
Yeah, our Newsbusters listeners will probably remember that I did a monologue back in November, I believe it was, or early December, where I talked about Ruhle, and she was saying that the, quote, dirty little secret here was while nobody likes to pay more, on average, we have the money to do so. So basically, she was basically saying that, like, people are complaining about paying higher inflationary prices, but the dirty little secret is that they can actually afford it. But she actually had a slight change of heart last night, where she did admit that the higher inflationary prices are hurting average Americans.
Yeah, it's because I think a lot of them are really finally coming to the realization that, this is not going to help the Democratic Party, and it's not going to help the left. And look, you know, both of us are too young to remember the Carter years, but from someone I love history and I like reading about it, this sure sounds like it, where you have inflation, where you have, you know, Jimmy Carter talking about a crisis of confidence, and essentially that Americans need to just deal with things being worse off and suck it up. I mean, that kind of sounds like what the liberal media is doing now in 2021, going into 2022, that they want people to just stop complaining and deal with it.
Yeah, I think we might have been, if going into Thanksgiving, if things had gotten any little worse, Biden probably would have had to come up onto the stage and tell people to turn down the thermostat and wear a sweater.
Right.
But then again, we also have to remind our listeners that this economic spin has come at the behest of the White House, where they brought in producers, news anchors, and been like, hey, you guys have to spin these numbers. Like, these are the numbers we want you to focus on. These are the numbers we want you to look at and show these to your audience to say this is the spin we want. This is how you need to frame it.
The gas prices, yeah. And we talked about that, and we wrote
10 cents.
Right, at Newsbusters, where it was suddenly a few pennies cheaper, and the journalists sure started talking about how things are getting better.
Exactly, especially when it's sort of a bit dishonest, because we know that they're paid a good amount of money, so they honestly either they don't notice it themselves, or if they have certain people would have probably drivers who pump the gas for them, they probably don't live in Jersey, so they're not like having the gas pumped for them. get out in the cold and pump your own gas like the rest of us. Joking aside, that's some of the stuff that we have on the homepage right now. Scott, is there anything that you're working on, excited that you have coming down the pike?
Well, I just put something up on Monday looking at how the media has not been covering in December, how they didn't cover Joe Biden's low polls. It's something that we've done a couple times, and it's just, again, it's the media trying to save, in this case, Joe Biden from himself. It's not working, but they are trying to just sort of pretend like he is not unpopular. The last three polls out in the Real Clear Politics average were 40, 40, and 41. So the way they respond to this, even if it's a poll from their own network, is in case an ABC did one in December, is they just basically ignore it and they pretend like it's not happening.
The only polls that they seem to be focusing on now are the polls of like Republicans saying that like that they don't, that they think the election was rigged. And I had a conversation with Tim Graham last night where like saying the election is rigged can be in the question can mean different things to different people. It could be what Trump claims in terms of like the election results and numbers and tallies, or it could be like what we found in one of our polls after the election is that the media biasing their stories, not covering the Hunter Biden story, means that people aren't getting the truth. They're not seeing the damaging news against Biden, and the news is rigged in that way. And because our poll showed that some people would have changed their vote if they would have heard about some of these stories.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great point. Look, a lot of people, when they hear that or if they're polled about it, they could simply mean that the media is in on it with the Democratic Party to try and help and save the Democratic Party. I think that's absolutely true. That's much different than saying the election was stolen or, you know, all these other things.
And that's one of the things, like when they were talking about like Trump's disapproval numbers, especially in the later years, one of the things I would point out is when you have the disapproval number, it's really sort of bifurcated into two different things. People who don't oppose that, people that are straight up oppose their policies altogether, and people who don't think their policies are going far enough. So when you're looking at the disapproval, you sort of have two different things. So even in the disapproval, you might have people that would vote for him because they generally like the policy, they just don't think they go far enough.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And just to one other thing, we're going to have, we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of Joe Biden's inauguration. So I'm doing a study kind of looking at some of the things that they didn't cover, that they really buried in the last year. And, you know, I think our listeners could guess a number of them. One of them is going to be Hunter Biden, all his scandals, the border, things like that. So we're going to have a piece on the 1 year anniversary of the inauguration.
That's really great stuff. So I just want to remind our viewers to come back and check out those pieces and our work in the future. And like Tim Graham likes to say, visit Newsbusters once, twice, 24 times a day. Goodbye.